we are talking with Barry from Best Buy, who's the Vice President of Marketing and, I guess, Chief Marketing Officer for Best Buy. Barry, thanks for joining us on the call.
Pleasure.
Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about you and who you are and where you come from.
Well, as you said, my name is Barry Judge, and I've been at Best Buy for about 9 years now, and my role is as the Chief Marketing Officer of the company. As with many people, probably are, you know, bound that way of getting to where I am, so I didn't set up to have this kind of role. I got to Best Buy actually through the internet about 9 years ago, as I said. .com was the place to be in marketing, and a group of people were bought into the company to try to sort of blow up the retail. You know, at the time, everybody thought that .com was going to take over at that moment for retail, for stores, and so that's where we were riding with the mandate to sort of blow the company up, and that's kind of what got me into each company. I'm kind of fashioning myself to be sort of the, like to be in changing and fast-moving environments, and that wouldn't be necessarily what a $4 billion company would be, but that's just how I got there. And I found that the company, because it's in retail and because it's been successful for 4 years, kind of has that in its DNA. It changes quickly and fast and, you know, kind of responding to competition and the consumer almost every day, it seems like. So that sort of environment is what attracted me. You know, before that, I was in a startup company called Imperial Coffee, and I was there from essentially one store to 150 stores. And before that, I was a packaged goods person, so I worked on a couple pretty big brands, Coca-Cola and Gatorade and Oberg. And now, as I said, in Minnesota, Minneapolis, from Canadian, actually, and moved to the States when I was five, and grew up in Toronto, and grew up in Connecticut, sort of an East Coast kind of person.
And with so you feel at home being in Minnesota, it's almost back in Canada, isn't it?
Well, yeah, if I grew up in Canada, probably, but I feel more at home in the New York area, actually. I'm getting to like the Midwest a lot. After living with business in Chicago and then worked there for 5 years, now I've been here for about 15, so I'm getting used to the Midwest, but it took a while. I talked to the best of Midwest people. you know, good place to be, with three kids, two dogs, and so good place to raise a family. That's all Snapchat.
You plan on staying in Minnesota?
No, I'm going to ride this thing out. Got a couple more years left in it, hopefully. And then I'm open to the right opportunity, actually. So I could be moving on after that. What to say? It's going to be actually where I choose to live, of all places. I live in the Caribbean, actually. But you're going to be where you are.
Well, you know what? I think you need to you need to pick your time. I think you need to live in Minnesota in the summer and then in the winter or something like that, because it gets really hot here.
Yeah. I think two or three places would be ideal.
Yeah. I know one guy who lives in New Zealand. Winters in Toronto. No, summer's in Toronto and winters in Florida, and that might be a good setup.
Yeah, Toronto, basically.
Yeah. All right, I'm fascinated to see that you turned up on Twitter. I've been using Twitter for a while. I noticed over the past 12 months, I don't even use Twitter more for like three to 4 months, but I've noticed over that time that I've been actively using it that more and more of the guys in my network and the media network are showing up on Twitter.
Yeah.
Some of them are using it pretty informally. I even see some CEOs of some of these companies, you know, the decent sized companies doing $200 million a year, getting drunk and Twittering. I'm curious as to what's prompted you to turn up on Twitter.
Yeah, I've only been using it for 3 weeks. And the problem is that I'm in marketing and I'm trying to understand where communication and people and culture and all these things are going. And I read about it, but I wasn't really participating in social media at all, MySpace, Facebook, really anything. But our company is trying to, I think, adopt a lot of sort of open architecture kind of philosophies. So we're very focused on not only the what we do, but the how we do it. And how we do it is trying to figure out how everybody in the company feels like they can contribute. Everybody's point of view is valid. So we're in this big effort around how we use collaborative tools to facilitate that happening. So in the company we have a number of them. One of them, probably, I don't know what you know from Twitter, but this thing called Blue Shirt Nation, which we launched a couple years ago. Two guys launched it. It was really not much bad. I get them the backing, but I didn't really know what was going on. And they just had a website where, outside of the firewall, where employees could talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. And it wasn't always, it could be an honest, genuine dialogue about what was good or bad about the company. And an example of, kind of what helps used was we changed our employee discount policy about 9 months ago around a couple of different things. And there was just an outrage on the Blue Shirt Nation about it. And, we actually ended up changing the policy as a result of all the conversation that was happening. And then from that, we had a number of other tools. We got something called a water cooler, which is a sort of an online forum, which is more focused on specific questions versus kind of being a place where you hang out, which is what Blue Shirt Nation is. And then we've got this thing called the predictive markets, which was actually in the Wall Street Journal last week, which is employees trading fictitious stocks. And the stocks are things that are happening in the company, whether they're going to succeed or not, whether they're moving forward or not. So it's the way the free market gets information to people, because sometimes they don't get told what's really going on. And then we have something called the Loop, which is an idea forum where you take your ideas out on this, in the site. and people can add to them and scratch them. You can invest them, save money, or real money, which is basically what I have, real money out there. So all of that kind of activity intrigued me. And then, as I said, there's a couple people, just with technology, you know, with all technology, profession ourselves as a technology company in some ways, a couple people that are heavily into social media know that I'm kind of up for things. And so they essentially told me, you know, get it on Twitter. This is, you know, I kind of started doing it, and I said, this kind of feels weird. I don't know what I'm trying to do here. And they sent me this Zappos guy's guide to the upfights running on Twitter, and so he felt weird, so I felt the candidate that. And started doing it, and they get some people follow. And I'm normally pretty just ecos direct, transparent, honest. And I started talking about things that were on the company, and a bunch of five people, you know, jumped on. I don't even know how to get a hold of me, but some other people jumped on. And, you know, they set up a blog for me, so I'm writing a blog. And just,
I see, I tweeted out that you had joined Twitter, and so I saw that and started following you. You think that you wanted to get some sort of social media presence, and that's why I
exactly. Interviewed. Yeah, so anyway, I think I've been jumping in for a month now. I'm just seeing, I feel like I've just, you know, struck a new vein of things I can learn about, and just participating in it, and just see more, so many more possibilities than reading about it. And you can just see how it's going to change. I think it's ultimately going to change the way we work. It's like an inflection point of some sort. I don't know what it is yet. But I'm seeing, I'll get into this in the interview, there's so much possibility in it. So that's what got me going, and I'm more of an advocate now to participating. And I find myself talking about it with everybody. No, I'm not sure if that's happened to you when you first got involved, but it's very interesting. So, long
my first switching was actually from, I started getting my tested out and got working from Cuba.
Oh, yeah?
And I think I'm probably the first person to use Twitter from Cuba. I was pretty excited about doing it. Yeah, it's still there, you know, like a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I took a trip to Cuba. I'm Australian, I can do that. And got it working from cell phone there, and so I was actually able to post from the web from Cuba on Twitter, which is kind of a little bit shocking to do that, because you know, Cuba's a really shut-down country, so that's, I think, one of the interesting things about Twitter, the sort of absolute enablement of communication. I'm curious then, I mean, obviously, we don't know what Twitter's doing. There's potentially a lot of value in there. What kind of value are you seeing from it for you, or where do you see any potential?
Well, so far, it's a way for me to get information I might either not normally get or get it faster. So one example was, I made a mistake. So we sent an email that we were doing a test on the program, and we were testing about 1,000 people, and email about programs was about 1,000 people, and the mailing house that we used, actually sends it to about 6.9 million people versus 1,000. And so all of a sudden, I have this application in my office actually that monitors the key social media sites, kind of on a big monitor, and kind of scrolls like a stock ticker. I don't, you know, look at it, I just kind of stare at it, you know, I stare at it a little bit when I'm, you know, fading out a little bit. And I just happened to see all these posts about the program, the rewards on the black card. I was like, what? I couldn't figure out why, because I knew it was going to 1,000 people. I didn't actually know when it was going, but I knew, didn't think it would be creating so much chatter. I didn't know what to think of it. And then I started realizing there's something wrong. And so I ended up calling up the people that run the program. I said, what's going on? And they didn't actually know. And then they called the mailhouse, and they found out. So, and then through that process, I became very concerned about consumer reaction. And the people that I was working with on this their program, because they weren't monitoring the same way I was, it didn't feel as real to them, because it was sort of clinical. I was reading consumer issues, and so I think our response was more transparent about what happened, and our response was also trying to be more empathetic, I think, than it would have been. So that's one example. Another one is our recent acquisition of Napster. So we bought Napster, or we had an agreement with them, you know, the diligence coming to buy them. And actually, I talked about it on Twitter, and I posted a blog entry on my blog about why we bought them. And Napster's one of those, I became very aware of, Napster's one of those digital brands that people have a real opinion about. Either they like it or they don't like it, but it touches the nerves. So when I posted it, in the several hours, I got over 100 people following me, additional people following me on Twitter. That never happened before. I got like 20 or 30 a day, but I got over 100 people in 2 hours. So I kind of realized something was going on. And I was reading, I read the responses from my blog and some of the ideas on Twitter, and after I realized the people that are actually, running our digital strategy internally, they have a lot of input they could be getting that I don't think they're getting. So we had a conversation the next day with myself and a couple of other people there, social media people, and things kind of changed. The idea that we came up with is, you know, no one really knows where digital music is going, no one's happy with it, and we have no vested interest because we don't have a digital music business, really. Why don't we think about using communities to develop our strategy? Because everyone's a care, and they also know how hard it is. So, you know, why don't we have some kind of point of view going in about what we should do? Why don't we open up the development of that strategy to, you know, Twitter and other places. And we'll see. But I think there was a real sort of connection with that idea with that business team. And selfishly, not only, you know, if we come up with some ideas, but I think that could help Best Buy brand a lot. If we built it really in that way. It wasn't a marketing gimmick, but we really did build it that way. So anyway, that was the second thing.
Do you think it will work with Napster? I mean, there's already been other companies that have acquired an Napster and tried to do things with it and haven't really gone very far. Do you think that was something that will work?
I don't know. We'll see. I think, you know, one difference is what pretty big company with lots of resources. The reason that's good, we have lots of resources, money, and people that we can grow. And the commitment to trying to figure out how we can participate visually. Be it, you know, one of the advantages we have in that is that we sell, you know, one out of every three devices, you know, PCs to people. So there's an opportunity to talk about digital services, digital kinds of content at the point of sale. So there's an opportunity there. Additionally, you know, we've got about 80 million people in our consumer database. And we got about 3 million people in our reward zone program. So there's opportunities for us, and we have a valuable proposition that we can connect on. We'll see if we can come up with a valuable proposition. But, you know, I think we've got the touch points that it's possible.
You own a lot of consumer relationships, and so I guess it's how far you can take that. Have you done other things like this? Have you sold something that you've made internally rather than being a distributor?
That's a good question. I think we're thinking about the Napster business in a number of ways. One of them is as a brand. Another one is as a platform. A third way is to sort of get more digital DNA into our company. And I think we're trying to, like many people, we're trying to figure out what's the point of digital. Is it about customer relationship strengthening? Is there a business model in there? I think we're going to participate and try to figure out those pieces. To the point of whether we've actually been more than a middleman, in the sense of what you said. Yeah, we have been. You know, we've got about 10% of our sales are through our own private labels. We've got four or five private labels that we develop our own product. We have the number two selling television in America, you know, as a partially the result of the number of people that went to our store, which I think is sort of indicative of what we could do is we come up with a decent value proposition. In addition, you know, all our services businesses are, you know, essentially done by us. Geek Squad is our brand, our people. Most of the other competitors in the space are third-party in their service. That's actually our brand. So good examples of us doing it. Certainly that is not typical, so it will take a little more effort.
You know, it's an interesting point, because I guess Walgreens and some of these others will have private label of their own. They're licensed for, I don't know, they buy them very cheaply from other companies that produce, like, pills and things like that, and then sell content in quantity under the Walmart or Walgreens brand. Is that the sort of stuff that you guys do as well, or are you trying more for making new things, like trying to get after the work?
I think we do both. So we don't. No, we work with just like Sony or Panasonic or whomever. We work with plants and we produce. You know, essentially we all use the same 4 or 5 plants. And you know, in Asia, to create televisions or create DVD players, whatever it happens to be. We do that. We do try to differentiate. You know, some of it is just, you know, good, better, best. That's essentially a knockoff of somebody else. But then we can figure out how to bring something to market that no one else brings. We do. Our portable DVD player is the most fun DVD player in America, and it's got features that nobody else has around focusing on moms. It's got a bunch of spill-proof features that nobody else has. It has a place to remote control shelves that nobody else has. So it's got things nobody else has. We've got some wireless speakers nobody else has created. I think we're trying to move more into that value chain. You know, we're not going to be the leader, because we don't have the R&D that all of the other manufacturers have, but we are creating that anew. Again, I think we're innovating in a big way in the services business. We just came out with a premium Wi-Fi protection, premium assurance / warranty products this last week. I think, you know, for our examples of innovating, doing things new, there's always an opportunity to essentially cut up the manufacturers and sell our own label.
Oh, I know, we should put the Napster. That'd be great if someone could get it
worked. Yeah.
On Twitter, have you seen that there's a user called Comcast Air?
I haven't seen that one. Is that Comcast?
Yeah, it's Comcast. It's a guy, I think his name is Frank, and he's somewhere in Comcast, and now I think he's authorized sort of at the top levels of the company. And so basically when people go around complaining and hearing about Comcast doing whatever they've done, they can go and get in touch with him, and he's the guy in the code and has some level of authority to rectify things internally. So he's sort of helping manage a little bit the Comcast brand on Twitter.
Yeah, we have somebody who's our customer, a couple people, I believe, who are in our customer care area that do the same thing. I'm noticing that a lot of brands do that. Depot does that. AT&T does that. You know, we're out there. I think we're trying to understand what conversation is about our brand. I don't know if we're necessarily going to fix things, you know, based on what we read on Twitter, in terms of that direct issue. But certainly, and we do, but it also certainly helps us understand, you know, the extent some issues exist.
You're in a tough position in a lot of ways. I mean, FBI is the supplier to volume of computers. So it's got to be a supplier to a large percentage of bloggers who are very vocal and active in what they say. They have a lot of rankings in Google, and so they have a lot of power. How on earth do you get in and work with that sort of thing?
I'm not following the question.
Well, I mean, there could be a lot of complaints around the web. I mean, I see praise about Best Buy, but I also see a lot of complaints and stuff like humorous and stuff like that. I mean, how do you get in and work with that kind of stuff? That's a tough position to be in, isn't it?
Well, I think I think what's important, so let's see, we might have 100 million, 500 million transactions a year.
Right.
And, you know, over a billion interactions, and like way more than a billion interactions. so the chances of getting one of those right is pretty remote.
obviously not going to happen. That's the thing, but then if the complaints are going to stand out.
Yeah, I think the important thing is we want to make it easy for people to complain because we want to know what's going on. And because the only way we can actually address anything and get better, because our intent is always get better. We're not going to put it, as we just discussed, more and we'll be perfect. But we do believe we can get better. We think we've gotten better and we continue to get better. And I think the conversations that are happening on the web are real ones. I don't really agree with them, but it is what it is. They're out there. And I think to the extent we can encourage people to tell us what they think, the better we're going to get. And that's kind of the mantra. That's kind of, as I mentioned earlier, about why I'm on social media, I'm on social media, just to hear the real stuff. You know, as a CMO, I don't hear the real stuff often, always. I wish I did. On Twitter, I'm finding not only are customers telling me the real stuff, at least what they think, and it's just lots of customers, because not every kind of customer is on Twitter. But the employees that go on Twitter, I have a different kind of dialogue with them than I would just seeing in the elevator. So I just think that hearing the real stuff is what's important. You can do something about it.
Are you familiar with the site called consumerist.com?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They got an agenda.
Yeah, I think I've seen you guys on there
so much. Well, there you go. So it's good to know what's going on. Again, we're not going to change the point of view of a specific editorial, which is what the consumerist is about, is, you know, exploiting situations in a way that drives readership. So it's kind of one of those places that's not, it's not ABC as a consumer. You know, it's kind of a fringe. But it's important to know what's going on with it. So we look at it, we read it, and we'll respond in a way that's true to who we are. But we also don't necessarily agree with all the editorial that's written on its site. I think most...
That's interesting. So you do want all this stuff out in the open, the good, bad, and the ugly, and
yeah.
So that you can work to address the things that you feel are problems and keep managing the business as best as you can according to your...
I think it's important is for people to, as a retailer, especially in a space, is for people to trust us. And the only way people trust us is we need to be behave in a way that, that someone would trustworthy. And I think part of that is just kind of sharing really what, being honest, genuine, and open about what's good and what's bad, what's working, what's not working. And basically just letting people go through it. We're trying to make things better. We're trying to improve. We're hearing what's going on. And, there's a little legacy in our industry of, not always owning up to really what's going on and getting half answers and shying away from things. And as a company, we've done a lot of work around re-engineering the thought. And I think this is part of it, is just acknowledging what's good and what's not good. We want it all. And I think, again, how we use social media, going forward, and maybe we start somehow getting all those conversations on our websites. So people, it's not hard for people to hear people, but what's being said about SI. Both are good and bad, because it's being said. Whether we want to acknowledge it or not, it's being said. Why not make it easy?
And then you can learn from it, and in cases where it's necessary, fix it, and so on.
Let's make it easy. Now, Robert Stevens, who's the founder of BeefSquad, so with SI, he said to me, and I always stuck in my head, let's make it really easy for customers to complain. We want to hear it. Then we can do something about it. So let's do all we can to make it easy. So maybe this will be another example of making it easy for people to complain.
Yeah, it's a little different when it's online, though, and stuff sticks around forever and, thousands of pages of complaints.
I think the experience is getting better. It's improving. We address things. I think we'll be clear for that, too.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I'm interested in your online store. Is that do you do a large percentage of your sales through online? I know that was something you started there by, wasn't it?
Yep. Honestly, I can't remember whether we talk about our specific sales online or not. I can look at the things over. We're not allowed to say what our actual sales are. It's significant. Because we do, in the U.S., we do about $35 billion in total revenue. So you can imagine that we do a lot of business online as well, given the product that we sell. So it is significant. We're, one of the largest retailers online as well as being the largest offline. We're strong in certain categories, naturally. You expect that. And when we look at our value proposition online, part of our value proposition online is that we have source. When you think about, as you said, a differentiator versus Amazon. So products that lend themselves to having a offline component, like I want to go look at the television and see how it works. I want to lift up the notebook and see how heavy it is. Those kinds of businesses we do better online. Businesses where, you've got a lot of stickiness built in, like Amazon does with, the personalization and, basically all the history that they've been able to build up and make that site better for you. We don't do as well in those businesses. But it's important for us. There's channelship that's going on, so it's going to continue to go on. We don't think stores are going to go away ever, but we do know that the direct-based selling via the Internet is going to become a bigger place of them going forward. So we're doing a lot to invest, not only in BestBuy.com, but also, and we talked about this a little bit on Twitter, and I'm going to blog about this hopefully this weekend, is looking at alternative brands that we can launch online, with a different value proposition with BestBuy, the brand known for.
Alternative brands.
There's different brands, different ways of competing online, the multi-channel brand can't do. And there's one opportunity. And if they don't like Best Buy, it's another opportunity. So we want to build up their share of pie. Potentially launching another brand that's not Best Buy might make some sense. Launching or buying.
Yeah. Yeah, that could be, yeah. got the equity grit strategy. We use that on sometimes with internet marketing stuff. Got some particular site that's selling well. You're going to get knocked off anyway, so you may as well knock yourself off and get the extra traffic growing that way. So I guess it's applying the same strategy of retail.
So in a lot of ways, so it's easier, well, not necessarily easier, but you can envision going national online faster than you can with a store. Think about most store brands. If you actually dig into them and look at them deeply, they've been around 20, 30 years, because they've bounced around for like 10 years trying to figure out what their idea even is. You know, and then as they get the idea, then you've got to scale out stores. Stores are expensive to build, and it takes a while to densify a geography so that advertising can make sense. So if we had a store, retail store-based brand right now, it would take us 15 years to roll the thing out across the country. No one has enough money to. And it takes a while to roll out awareness, too. So in some ways, you can go faster online, interestingly.
So online, you have your online store, you're doing online sales. Do you have much of an affiliate program? Are you doing a lot of affiliate stuff?
We do pretty good business that way. We're spending a lot more time, honestly, figuring out how to make our website more relevant, more shoppable, because what the bigger impact for us is how the website, even though we sell a lot online, how the website actually impacts in-store sales, retail sales, in-store sales, brick-and-mortar sales, whatever that we're going to call. So we spend a lot of time actually building up our feature set online so that we can help our offline business. So I wouldn't call us a leader in affiliate marketing. We do a decent business, but more time spent on how we can actually help you figure out when to buy in our stores.
To give you a comparison, I talked with some numbers with some guys that are doing, $1 billion a year, and they booked out 10-20% of their volume coming from affiliates.
Yeah, that's what we do. We're bigger than $1 billion online.
Right, so obviously your sales is bigger. So,
yeah.
Well, I mean, $35 billion a year in total revenues, that would put you $3.5 billion through affiliates.
No, I meant 20% of our online business. Not 20% of our
business. 20% of online, right.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Do you do a lot of work with direct response marketing? How does direct response fit in with that? Because obviously you do have a brand, you do a lot of branding advertising.
Direct response, we have as I mentioned earlier, we have 29 million people for sure in our rewards and loyalty program. So over 50% of our sales are run through with using our card. And that is a tremendous source of understanding consumers better than we would if we didn't have that card. In addition, a few months ago, we launched a silver tier within our reward zone program, in which we're building into experiential benefits, you know, return policy differences, when you call us on the phone, you get prior, you know, you have a special phone number, early access, or guaranteed access to certain kinds of short inventory products like these, et cetera. So within that, there's a lot of direct marketing that goes on. In addition, we've built out a number of different models that are very predictive in terms of who will respond to direct marketing offers and who won't. So we do, during the year, we do about 8 programs where we invite people into sales, you know, during 12 months of the year based upon, understanding the future value as well as who will respond to direct marketing. As well, we do a number of trigger programs. So we have a pretty good understanding of once you buy product X, you know, if you buy flat-panel television, we know over the next 12 months the kind of purchase that, the kind of product that you're likely to want to buy based upon a history of other people who bought that product. And we'll send out email or direct mail and inviting you to buy the product that you're probably going to want. So I'd say about of our mix, specifically include reward zone, now 25-30% of our mix is in direct marketing.
So you have very common direct marketers on staff, and that is an important part of your organization?
Yep.
That's interesting. You mentioned the card where you're tracking purchase behavior and analyzing and understanding people better. How does that work?
How does it work? What do you mean?
Yeah, like what do you actually end up understanding? What sort of patterns do you end up seeing and things like?
Well, we understand, first of all, how much the customer is worth to us. And that's important because it helps us understand, as we get to more customer-specific investments, which are mass investments, we spend more money on retaining this kind of customer, or another kind of sexual customer, versus another customer that might come into us once or twice or, you know, 3 times a year. In addition, we use it to understand not just frequency of purchase, but profitability. And we know we have our entire customer database. We've been able to essentially assign profitability every one of them. So we break them into deciles. Top decile, bottom decile, and there's a lot of interesting stuff in the top decile and the bottom decile. But, you know, the bottom decile people are interesting. The top decile are obviously interesting because they're the most profitable people. The bottom decile are interesting because they actually, for us, we lose a lot of money on those people, but they're not necessarily, you know, quote-unquote bad customers. They're actually kind of good customers. They're buying all over the store, and they end up buying things that aren't that profitable for us. So the opportunity around is to try to figure out they're very engaged with us. How do we put more profitable ideas in front of them than the ones that make us lose money? So it helps us understand customer-specific investments. And then, as I talked about, because we have an understanding of what people are doing, we can do much more effective direct marketing. And then lastly, it helps us understand when our sales are up or down in particular business or geography, we can understand who we're up or down with. And then that helps us fine-tune our promotional strategy, even on a mass basis.
So really, I mean, mean, because I have really very little understanding of retail. My experience is all internet-based. But really, although you talk about your marketing mix being 25 to 30% of the overall company's marketing, in fact, a Best Buy store is like a little direct marketing test pool where you're like testing all kinds of stuff all the time to see what works.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of, I talked earlier about creating a sort of open architecture culture, and that's kind of what we want to get to in the sense of it's not my responsibility to come up with all the marketing ideas. If we can really enable a culture that people believe and is accountable to the fact that they need to come up with their own marketing ideas, then all of a sudden you have versus 25 people in marketing department trying to come up with stuff, you got 150,000 people across the company trying to come up with stuff. And that's kind of what, if every store has a plan, then they get some things from the corporate office, but they also have a responsibility to come up with things the corporate office can't see. Because there's no way it's centralized.
Isn't that how McDonald's came up with the egg muffin?
I don't know. Could be.
I thought it was something like that. Some store started doing it, and it just worked really well, and they didn't like it initially, and then finally it worked so well that they just rolled it out everywhere.
Makes sense. You can't think corporate office can come up with lots of things, but I think they can come up with egg muffin with everything, because we all live in Minnesota, I'm not sure how that would really be possible. So to the extent we can do that, that's kind of the big bet we're making, is really trying to enable that to happen for real.
But then you have to do that while still protecting the brand and the customer experience.
Yeah. I think you can do that through providing bumpers. So we've got a brand idea, and we've broken the brand idea down into five sort of ways. It's brought to life, but they're big ideas, and so they're not telling you to do this, do that. They're ideas around, we have one of our promises called Never Leave You Hanging. So I know we leave people hanging, so you can read it in commerce, you can read it in Twitter, but we're trying to get better at never leaving the customer hanging. And so if a store takes that as our mantra, they can act in the moment in a way consistent with that. Because everything's happening in retail store in the moment. You're in front of them as a consumer, and things are happening, and they can remember these blood-based principles in their head. More often than before, they can make the right kind of decision.
What you're talking about the card is very interesting. So you have the card, you can look at member data, you can see which are the most possible lifetime customers. And so then when you understand who they are better, you can then target your outbound advertising data, both branding and direct marketing focus, to attract those people, can't you?
Yep.
And so therefore you can afford to pay a dollar amount to reach those people, and therefore you're more competitive in buying that media, which helps grow the store in the market to your promise.
Yeah, there's a thought, because we understand, we can't understand profitability by a customer. There's a thought, we just worked on this yesterday, that we actually are making too much money on the customers that are most profitable. We should be investing more in them and making them hopefully more loyal with how we're investing, in experiential improvements like the return policy I talked about, and then trying to figure out how the people that are string dollars, how we can make them more profitable. And then the middle people spend less on them because they're not really contributing much at all. So we're trying to get to a
point. You want to take that too far.
Yeah, exactly. But the idea that the people that are the most loyal, make sure that they don't go anywhere. So make sure you invest in them because they're going to drive your business going forward. You can't lose those people because I'm sure most businesses are the same way. If you lose one of those customers, you need to get 80 new customers or whatever it is. It's always that way. And so you shouldn't just treat them like everybody else. Treat them differently and then you have a better chance of holding on to them.
This is how we do everything online. I mean, a site like Facebook, for example, try a new feature, and then they'll test it or optimizing around something like user engagement, and they'll be able to see in a pretty short period of time what with a new feature, if the user engagement increases or decreases.
Yep.
And that can help them decide whether or not to keep the feature. It's the same sort of metrics-driven testing. That's brilliant.
It is faster online, but you can still do it. You can still do it in the store.
Well, you guys have so much volume, too. I mean, just roll out a couple stores, and that could be your end, doesn't it?
You can read it, yeah. Well, but we're seeing a lot of geographical differences, too. So. It's interesting something that that's why another reason why we have to develop a culture where everyone has to contribute, because there's between more and more differences geographically than we've ever seen before. The U.S. is it's like eight countries.
How would you group the different regions? What are the differences?
Well, I think ethnicity is big, so that's a big factor, as well as the underlying economy and the kind of business that we're in. The underlying economy is critical, and we had this crazy week last week, right? But the housing market is not bad everywhere. So where the housing market is better, like in Texas and the Southwest, not all the way to Arizona, but right before Arizona.
That's except for Galveston, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, but in Galveston now, with the hurricane, they didn't get all that insurance money, and that can actually be a very big growth area now for us, because people are going to have to rebuild their homes. And even for building homes or moving, that's good for us. So the point there is, even if you're thinking about making investments in labor or math media or whatever, you're not going to get the same return. The same message because of the underlying economy and the ethnic differences. And the underlying economy is housing. It's also the kind of industry that's doing well and not so well, and the kind of the tech savviness of the people, et cetera. So even when one of our territories is in the west of Chicago and Indianapolis and Detroit, those three markets are performing very differently. Because it's different. And there's all kinds of factors. So another reason why it can't be done centrally, it has to be done locally.
Have you read about or looked at, do you have an account on Facebook?
No, I don't. I'm going to get one now that the Twitter thing going, because I just didn't understand
all
this stuff.
But a lot of my meeting members guys are all on Facebook, and so you can add more. Facebook is, there's two approaches for internationalizing that I've seen. One is just pay a big company or a company to go and do all the international versions of your site. Facebook's doing it a different way, which I find really interesting. And I've heard some complaints about it. It seems to be working now, where they say, okay, we're now making every single language in the world, and those of you who want, you know, particular, you know, like random African languages that not many people speak, you can just go on and do all the translation yourself. And so then it's some sort of peer review process that the version goes through various levels until it's finally ready, and then they roll it out. And they initially rolled it out on the Spanish language version. I think there were some problems with it initially. But it seems, as far as I can tell, they're ironing the bugs out, which means the localization for Facebook will be done locally everywhere in the world. And so they will end up with every single kind of really localized language, which sounds like a little bit similar to what you're talking about with some of the marketing that you're trying to do with Best Buy.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think that has to, like what I was talking about before, I think that's a great idea, but it has to allow for some sort of localization, though. I don't think you can pick Best Buy up and stick it all over the world and have connection, and it should be exactly the same. Within the core of it, you know, the brand, the picture brand is the same, but the way it brought to life in a particular culture, it should be different.
Yeah, I have an interesting example I've seen. My local gym is Gold Gym. So a big American brand on here in the Dominican Republic. Yep. And they won't let them play reggaeton, which is the local music, which is really popular, which I personally can't stand, but everyone else seems to really like it. They won't let them play it because it's considered their corporate style, and they're not allowed. And so here in the DL, where people actually would really like to hear it, they're not allowed to.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the sort of allowances you're talking about.
Yeah.
Obviously, I've got, and people will be listening and reading this, there's a couple of guys that have very big graphic websites, you know, doing multiple billions of impressions per month. And there's sort of guys that would love to engage you guys in some sort of a branding campaign. How does that sort of thing normally work? How do they talk with you about it, and how does that sort of thing happen?
Well, usually it would be through our ad agency, which is Avenue A. So typically that's, we've got a lot of opportunities, we've got a lot of money, and typically the filter is through them, so that they're always strategy. We're a command them, actually. We give them the strategy, and they go to go at it twice.
Do you work with the ad agency, and then you kind of put an overall plan, like a media plan, and how it looks, and then the ad agency goes and does the individual filtering of all the
exactly.
sort of stuff?
And honestly, I don't do it. I can find out. I don't get, you know, we spend over $500 million a year in marketing. So
right.
I don't get involved in all these other different ways of bringing it to life. I couldn't possibly do that too much.
No, I can imagine. So one of the things that's really interesting is, like with some of the websites, there's interviews that we've run talking about this, where they love branding campaigns for a company like Best Buy, because, you know, they can just, then, you know, have a certain number of CPMs and then just stick them up on the site, and they'll burn through those really, really quickly with no real perceivable return. You don't particularly look for a call to action or anything like that. You just want the banner in front of people. I mean, from your perspective, you're the marketing guy on the line that's ending up paying for all this stuff. How does that work for you?
Well, we use market, I mean, depends what it is. We use advertising for different purposes. Some purposes are for, you know, we want people to click, and we're trying to drive engagement that, you know, during that moment or within, we actually look over a 7-day period. Other times, we're trying to drive an impression, because with the products that we sell, we're also trying to get top-of-mind awareness, meaning, you know, you might not be ready to buy a television today when you see an ad from us, but 3 months from now, you start thinking about popping your head for some reason you want to buy a television, we want to be there in your head. So advertising is done for both purposes. And actually, in mass media, we try to be more general, because, and I talk about Best Buy brand, because most times, I mean, most people aren't interested in buying a specific product next week. There might be people ready to buy a product, but, you know, the percent of people that want to buy a PC are, you know, it's like 10% of the people. The percent of people that want to buy a TV, it's another 10% of the people. If we get really specific in mass medium, then we kind of turn off everybody else and just focusing on a 10. If we can land the brand idea, we can sort of bring in all the people that are thinking about buying whatever they're thinking about buying. Online is more targeted, so we typically do less awareness building stuff online, and we actually are trying to drive a action to our website.
Oh, so generally online, you are moving to always driving some kind of action?
Generally, because again, people are getting more specific. I think we call it the purchase funnel. Broad-based media, we don't know who we're attracting, we're trying to land, it's a general idea. Specific sites can give us an idea that people are in a certain mindset, and so we can try to get them to do something. We're typically trying to do something. Now, it isn't all buying. We want to move them to the purchase funnel. So if you're in consideration, you know, you're not right, your consideration means you're thinking about what to buy. We want to get to the next phase, which is I want to buy. Versus I have to buy. Because when you think about buying a television, you know, the typical thought process takes like 6 months from idea generation, I want to buy a television, to actually buying one. Because people are thinking about what they want to do for a while. Researching and studying. So we're trying to move people along where they're at.
What percentage online now would you say is based around action versus just branding?
Online, I'd say it's high. You know, 90%.
I'm impressed. That's really good to hear. Very cool. All right. Is there anything we haven't talked about you'd like to talk about?
No, I think that's good.
Cool. Well, very thanks for your time.
Okay, great. I missed that.